Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Seats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
The first thing that President Obama ever said to me, we had all gone to meet him in the East Room, the largest room, and so we were all circled around the outside of the room. He's going around shaking hands with everybody. We had already served some desserts. So I was sort of like standing there, like ready for his accolades, you know. Yes, I know you've had some of these. He comes around and it's, oh, the pastry chef, you make the pies. Yes, sir. Stop making so damn many pies.
Because I'm sure you'd heard he was a pie freak, right?
Yeah.
Today we welcome my old friend, Bill Yosis. Man, we haven't seen each other in years, dude.
Nice to see you.
Bill was the White House executive pastry chef from 2007 to 2014, where he was closely involved with First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign. Prior to his time at the White House, Yosis was the executive pastry chef at the Dressing Room up in Westport, Tavern on the Green, and most famously, I guess, at Boulay. He has given lectures on science and cooking at Harvard University and is the founder and chair of the Kitchen Garden Laboratory, which uses science to teach children about healthy cooking. He is the winner of the 2013 James Beard Who's Who Award. I won one of those too, Bill. So they give them to anybody.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
It's like the Legion of Honor these days.
And he is the author of a brand new book, The Sweet Spot, Dialing Back Sugar and Amping Up Flavor. Welcome to Special Sauce, Bill Yosis.
Thank you.
And you did show up with pie. I was really worried about that.
Of course. It's sort of expected these days.
All right. So tell us about life at the Yosis family table. You grew up in Toledo, right?
Yes, Toledo, Ohio. It was a sort of Ozzie and Harriet upbringing, 50s American family, dinner every day at 5:30.
5:30, that's early.
That's dinner time.
That's Midwestern dinner time.
Midwestern dinner time, that's probably late. So, God forbid if you weren't there or you didn't make it back home in time.
Your mother
for that.
Took dinner time seriously.
Took it seriously, and she took the cooking seriously. Always she cut out recipes from the home magazines and was always baking and cooking up a storm, and she really enjoyed it. And I had absolutely no interest in any
Zero.
Of it. Zero. Actually, there was a few, oddly enough, seeing that I sort of dropped it for a long time, baking interested me. The cakes interested me. I think I had sort of a sugar, interest early on. But
who doesn't?
Right.
When you're a kid.
It's like the natural thing to eat. So my mom loved to cook, and we loved eating. But fairly straightforward American.
Like, what did she do really well?
Beef stroganoff, I remember. That must have been in Life magazine or something
right.
One week. And so we always requested that. That was really nice.
And what did she bake?
A lot of cakes, a lot of layer cakes. Cheesecake, of course. Mamie Eisenhower had the lock on cheesecake recipes in those days.
So you always gravitated towards the White House,
I guess that was what planted the seed.
Did you ever go out to eat?
Yeah, special occasions, we did. Fancy food, I was introduced to that by my uncle, who used to take us out. He had a rather well-to-do job in the glass industry, which is big there still. And so he used to take us kids out to fancy dining places. And I can remember the first time I had lobster in Toledo, Ohio, was with him. And
at a Continental restaurant, Calvin Trillin used to call La Casa de la House or something.
Yes, right.
The House of
right,
the House.
Yes. And they usually had like a Chinese portion of the menu and then Continental. And
right.
They try to, and I think they still do, they try to cover all bases.
Right.
I always love that when you see like sushi and Thai food.
Yes. No, that's happening more and more now.
Yeah.
So when you were growing up, mm-hmm. what did you think you wanted to do?
The usual sort of policeman, fireman, priest.
Priest?
Which comes in handy these
wow,
days.
Wow, man. Priest, that's some heavy stuff.
Yeah, they They didn't want me.
You were already too far gone.
Oh yeah, I was too far gone. When I was in school, I started to study French when I was in college.
Right, and you actually have a bachelor's and a master's in French and French literature.
Yeah, and that's what really turned me on to the culinary scene and gastronomy. And as soon as I had a chance to go to France, I did. And I didn't even know that I was being sort of sucked into this, you know, culinary world. But I don't know. I just had I got bit by the bug and have never regretted it.
How did you move forward once you realized you were bitten by the bug?
Yeah.
On the trips to France, which were not culinary trips per se,
no,
I assume.
No, they were not. No,
they were cultural trips.
They were cultural and research. And I decided to take a job in a restaurant, which was really, really hard. I was sort of used to, you know, basking in this academic environment, which is pretty cushy. And then to work in a French bistro, busy French bistro, was daunting. But I really loved it.
And where was that?
That was at a restaurant that was called La Fou. It was on the Rue Clément in the 6th arrondissement.
And how old were you?
I was about, by that time, I think I was maybe 23 or 24.
I mean, well, how'd you get it? Did you just knock on the door?
No, it was arranged through the school that I went to, which was the New York City Technical College in Brooklyn, and they arranged for it.
And you were in their hospitality program.
Yes, hospitality, as they call it. Still there, great school. But it was a very interesting, it was Lyonnais-style cuisine. So nothing I had ever learned about, even in cooking school. It was this
grandma cooking,
tripe, and every kind of awful OFFAL that you can imagine. But done just to perfection, and we had a golden clientele. There was the writer Roland Barthes,
really?
Mitterrand, before he was president, came
wow,
in after.
Wow, that's heavy.
And Raymond Barre, who was the anti-Mitterrand, he was the right side of the political spectrum. And one time, I remember they came in to eat the same day, and it was a very small restaurant. They had to put a partition up.
That's awesome.
Like corny, that's like, sort of little curtain thing.
That's a kind of precursor to life today in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, where nobody wants to look at the other.
Right.
So it was great.
And did you get your ass kicked?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The chef was gruff and but heart of gold. You know, it was the real deal. Got up at 3 a.m. to go to Rungis, the market, which is just, even today, I mean, if you're going to Paris, skip the Eiffel Tower and go to Rungis.
Which they've now refurbished.
I hear it's been, yeah. I have not been, yeah. But I heard it's really great now. Yeah, a little. And it's just mind-blowing. Airport hangar size warehouses of the best produce and meats that you can find.
Where every great chef and restaurant in Paris would shop, right?
And probably in Europe, because there's few other markets that are as well equipped to send food on.
Got it.
They get it from all over the continent and send it all over the continent.
Right. So there were shipping things and there was everything you needed.
Yeah, a lot to the Netherlands, to England. Any good restaurant someone was ordering from Rungis.
And so that was your first job.
That was my first job.
And did you love it?
I loved it. So just still
and you were
do.
Like,
I still
did
do.
You
still
feel like, do. Oh, why didn't anyone tell me there was
oh,
a job
absolutely.
Like this?
I was like, whoa, this is not what, you know, the frozen lobster in Ohio was all about.
So then what happened? When did you come back to the States?
Oh, if we're going to do this chronologically,
yeah.
We're going to be here a long time.
That's okay. I got time.
No, I came back. Actually, I started to go back and forth. Because I'd come back to New York. I'd work a little bit, earn some money. And
in a restaurant.
In a restaurant, yeah. I was often told the story that back in the States, I worked with Danielle Boulud, Thomas Keller, Alfred Portali, a few other unknowns.
Wow, that's crazy.
In one place, in the Polo restaurant, which was weird.
Right. That was in many ways a seminal restaurant, Polo restaurant in the Westbury Hotel.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Right? And people don't speak of that restaurant as being such an important sort of magnet restaurant in New York.
Yeah, because it was a three-star chef, Roger Verger, God bless him. He sort of brought everybody together. And That had happened before a little bit with Michel Gérard at Régine's.
Right.
The discotheque, and Michel famously hired Patrick Clark. And
who became the chef at Tavern on the Green.
Tavern on the Green. First, and Michael Romano.
Right, who was
well.
The first prominent African-American chef. Restaurant chef.
Yes, in America. And so these were real. It was happening fast then, but it was, like you said, it was a seminal experience, but it was also just pockets of it here and there.
Yeah, and actually, we should say that there were African American chefs in New Orleans before that, but we're talking about New York.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, where did you first see your name in the New York Times?
Oh, much later.
Really?
Yeah.
But you were still going back and forth.
I was still going back and forth. So I wasn't really a full-time New Yorker, or I hadn't put down roots long enough to really move up in the ranks. You know, it's a very hierarchical system, still is. The first time I saw my name in the New York Times was at Montrachet, because eventually I landed coming back from France, and I had known David Boulay for several years, and he was in San Francisco. We were chums, and he said, well, I have this great opportunity. It's in Tribeca. Can you work?
And we should say that Montrachet was a French restaurant that was serious and yet casual in Tribeca, also another seminal restaurant and profoundly influential. Drew Nepourhant was the restaurateur, and David Boulay was the opening chef, and you were the opening pastry chef.
That's right. And our menu was three-course menu for $16.
Whoa. Can I go today?
Yes.
That's so crazy. And what was it like working for Boulay at that time?
Very intense. He is a...
he's an intense dude.
He's an intense dude, and for my money, the most creative of chefs in America. Knows no boundaries, follows no creed, just intensely personal cuisine, which sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, but no one is more, I think, fearless on the piano than he is.
Right. In terms of craftsmanship and artistry.
Yeah, having the craftsmanship and yet trying not to stay lodged in a particular classic mode and looking for new. And now I still talk to him often, and he's working on these great, wonderful ingredients that are health-infused, and some of them are Japanese origin, South American, all kinds of really interesting health voodoo around food as medicine.
Yeah, I think he's one of those polarizing figures, I would say.
Certainly.
And whose reach exceeds his grasp, you know, which is part of his greatness, is that he is always one step ahead, and yet often the culture doesn't catch up in time.
I would agree with that, yeah. He's out there on the edge, and yeah, and it takes a certain willingness on the part of the clientele to sort of suspend belief and take a leap of faith, which if the meal's $300, you're not always interested in that leap.
Right. So why did you gravitate to pastry? Was it because of your kid-like obsession with sugar, or was there something that attracted you, like the precision, and like why sweets instead of savories?
Yeah, both of what you just said. For the real reason, we'd have to ask my therapist. But the
I'm actually standing in for your therapist.
You are, thank you.
We have to stop Bill.
I expect to get it's 45 minutes. I expect to get a bill. I love the precision, but I love the aesthetics more. When you think about food photography today, it's very hard to shoot a dish of meat.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard. As much as, I love the Otto Lengi style. I love that sort of mishmash of chaotic deliciousness. It makes me want to eat it, but I don't stand back and say, wow, I want to put that on the wall. You know, I want that. And I think I have that superficiality about me that I love images.
You're proudly superficial.
I'm proudly superficial and shallow. I love pretty pictures. And so that's what I think, really, that's what I loved. I love these pretty, because we're talking about, if we go back to, you know, when I really moved over into pastry, I mean, Nouvelle Cuisine was hot. These like beautiful plates with a dime-sized dessert on it, you know, and a one drop of sauce. And they made stunning photography.
Yeah.
And I think that's what really drew me to it, as well as the precision. And plus, I like a good dessert.
If you work for David Boulay and all those people, is there one style of chef that you learn more from? Were they all screamers?
I think that's overblown a little bit. Okay. There's tempers flare.
Right.
I mean, on every side. In these, they're hot and they're intense and there's a lot of pressure. I don't think creativity really happens without pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those moments of like coming up with a new dish or a new preparation.
In the moment.
Style, it happens often in the moment and under pressure.
Right.
So I have no problem with that. And I think I thrived in it.
So, and when you worked for Danielle, I was friends with his chef de cuisine, Alex Lee, for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And Alex used to talk about that Danielle would keep a running tab on what regulars were served. And if they came in and wanted a tasting menu, he'd say to Alex, okay, we can't serve them anything that they've ever eaten before.
Yeah.
Like, did you ever get confronted with that?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. That was, I would say that was the, that's
rule?
The rule more than the exception. The, you know, all these guys, Eric, Daniel, David, Thomas himself, and I mean, these, all of us had come out of the French system and where it's a very convivial and sort of family almost, you know, relationship mm-hmm. with the customer. And so they knew their clientele. They might serve us the same ingredient. I mean, a poulet de Brest is poulet de Brest, but they would prepare it in a different way. And we certainly tried to imitate that.
Do you think the French system is still relevant?
I do. It's one of the tried and true. And it is, you learn progressively and you're not promoted until you have a lot of these basics. You could compare it to the Japanese system where you know, do a certain amount of time.
Right, you could spend 5 years making rice.
Rice. And if you get it down that fast, you're pretty good. I'm sure it's modified these days. I'm not in the same type of kitchens now, so I don't know. But, you know, the what they used to say about Sully was, well, he had the 10,000 hours. And there's no replacement for the 10,000 hours.
Right.
That to really know your craft, you have to have that amount of time so that when you're confronted with that customer who's been in the restaurant 5 times this week and had everything that you have on your mind, you don't blow your cool and serve
right.
the same thing.
Got it.
So you need that background and the French system. Now, does it have to be a French system? I think Americans have adapted it in their own way
mm-hmm.
to our system, which is more egalitarian and which is not quite so rigid in terms of time spent and it's also less, I'll go out on a limb here, and I really think in the States in general, things are more merit-based. The old world, the continent, and England, there's very much a
hierarchy.
There's a hierarchy and a social order that is more difficult to change.
And a certain inflexibility.
That they hold on to because it's worked all this time. Why change it now? So kudos to us for allowing some flexibility into it, Americans, that is, American kitchens. But also we tend to throw the baby out with the bathwater and also not maintain standards as
yeah.
well here.
So you think that's really true?
I do think that's true. And finding that balance is the key to a successful restaurant today.
Got it. And the 10,000 hours, which Malcolm Gladwell made famous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that a lot of problems result from young American cooks getting out of cooking school and thinking they can trim that to 2,000?
No, I don't want to go there because... Mm-hmm. What we have today is a much more open landscape. So there are people who are really gifted enough to have either at home or in their professional lives, and they have down a certain style.
And they have a point of view.
And they have a point of view, and they cook it well, and they serve it well. What I'm talking about is the larger restaurant, the institutions of New York City, the Four Seasons, the
Daniel.
What used to be La Côte Basque, and that whole set. There, you can't just come in with one narrow interpretation and serve that.
Got it.
What I'm talking about is the training. What we started talking about is, you know, this French brigade. I love the like quirky restaurants where a chef has a certain style and like works it to death, and I'll go over and over again to. But I know I'm not going to have that gastronomic universe.
It lacks a breadth and depth of experience.
Yeah, yeah. Which is not to say we don't go to those restaurants. Some of the great, most fun places are like that.
You have gone through the French brigade system.
Mm-hmm.
You've worked in the White House. You've worked at restaurants. What's the one thing that you would tell people if they really wanted to become a pastry chef? One bit of wisdom that you would share?
My one piece of advice is taste your food constantly. Do not get... what happens to many chefs is, so I made this many times, I know what it tastes like, and do not become a robot. And it's hard.
Because if you're plating the same thing 500 times, it's easy
that.
To become
there's
a robot.
That, but also, we tend to build ourselves up in our own mind like, oh yeah, I've done this. I know what this combination tastes like, and I know by looking at it that it's right. Well, you probably know the texture, but it's very important to taste your food all the time. And you don't have to like swallow the whole piece of cake, but you have to know, because that gives you the connection with the person who's on the other side.
How did you make the transition? Like, had you had it with the restaurant business? At what point did you say, you know, I want to try something different?
When did I say that? What are we referring
well,
to?
Well, I just mean when you went to you went to work for the White House restaurants.
Oh,
right?
I see. Oh, well, no, I considered that an honor. I never thought that was going to pop up. And no, I wasn't rejecting anything. I was just, you know, that's how I growed up. If the White House asks you to do something, you should consider it an honor.
So how did that come about?
You know, it's sort of, they keep it a little bit shrouded in mystery. The person who was there before me, Roland Mesnier, had retired. And so they were looking for a chef. And
this was 2006, 2007?
Yeah, 2004 he retired. And they brought in somebody short term. And then that ended. And then, so they were out and they were like, kind of like, it's not the first thing on their minds.
Right.
But they
right.
were sort
Should
of
we
like...
deal with nuclear disarmament or shall we deal with finding a pastry chef?
That's right. So I'm sure it was Mrs. Bush. I'm sure she wasn't really thrilled about having to like, oh, another one. But yeah, they picked up a few magazines. And I think there was a picture in a magazine, I was told later, that they said, well, that looks, you know, let's try him. And they tried other people too, by
so they
the way.
Do so they
oh, yeah
a tryout.
They sifted through, there was a tryout, yeah. And so they asked me to come and do a sort of a tasting,
did they put any parameters on the tasting?
Yeah, there's you have to do a full buffet by yourself, because a lot of the entertainment in the White House is buffet. And then you have to do a plated dessert with a showpiece, you know, the sort of coup de grace at the end of state dinners and all that. And then a few, we had to do a breakfast also,
mm-hmm.
A sort of innovative breakfast. And so I did those, and they called me back.
And this was for Laura Bush. And
yes.
Who makes the final choice? Does the president or does the first lady, or is it a...
I would guess the first lady.
One of her duties.
They have other things to do in the Oval Office. But he was present. I was... asked to go into the dining room after serving what I had made, and I will never forget his very greeted me humbly, and I said, "It's an honor to be here, sir." And he said very quietly, "It is for me too."
Wow,
I thought it was kind of
so. You don't
moving.
Think in his case it wasn't folksiness? You think it was genuine modesty?
He's as genuine as they come. He's the real deal. And my New York liberal friends are always
appalled
at that I would be fond of this man. But You know, you meet a lot of fascinating, interesting celebrities while you're there, people who are like waiting for their turn to go on stage at the White House. And B.B. King was standing next to me one day, and I was just putting my cookies out. And he said, nobody can sit in a room with George W. Bush and not come away liking the man.
B.B. King said
that. If B.B. King said that, it's okay. It's fine with me.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
B.B. King's one of my heroes,
too.
He
was amazing. Amazing man.
Yeah, and like, you must have had so many experiences, first with the Bushes, right? And were there also negative experiences? Maybe you can't share them. Like, were people, some people dismissive or...
Yeah. There are. I mean, they consider themselves sort of among their peers, even though it's political peers, but entertainment people. And sometimes, you know, they would be asked to, I don't know, come back and meet the chefs, and they'd be like, "Are you kidding me?
Why would I meet that peon?
Dirty people.
How can those people? That person can't help me.
That's right. You know, that's a very rarefied world.
Compared to a restaurant, what was the pressure level like? What was the anxiety level?
It's high. Stakes are high. I would just say that I got to give a shout out to the resident staff, who are the people who work from one administration to the next. And they're not political appointees. They're hired to work at the House, the residents, and they usually stay on. I mean, I worked with people who had started working with Eisenhower.
Wow.
Yeah. And they're devoted to the job. They're also devoted to discretion. So you don't hear about them very often. I mean, you may hear the chefs or you know, a high-profile job, but there are carpenters, plumbers, housekeepers, florists, you know, there's a whole bevy of people that make that place run. And they're really committed to the job. And as I say, they're committed to keeping quiet because nobody likes the people who go out and tell stories about, I don't care who's in there. I don't care what your beef is, and there's plenty. Give them a little space. It's a tough job.
Right. And you successfully made the transition from the Bushes to the Obamas.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And is that typical or is that atypical?
Yeah. It's not atypical. People are always like, oh my gosh, you worked for both a red and a blue president. It's typical. It's not that unusual because the learning curve is so steep that if you had to change out, 100 people that know how this 200-year-old house works, it would be a catastrophe because it's very old building, and also a lot of the just where everything is daunting.
What was the atmospheric change like between the Bushes and the Obamas? It was beyond moving from a Republican administration to a Democratic administration.
Yeah, maybe a little more sort of willing to engage with us directly.
Mm-hmm.
The Bushes came from, he had already been governor. She had been, first lady of Texas. So, and plus, they grew up in a comfortable, moneyed situation. So they were used to having staff.
Got it.
And so they would prefer most often to go through the chain of command. And that works more smoothly that way
right.
in many ways. It's not that they didn't greet us, weren't happy to see us, didn't shake our hands. They did. But it sort of went through the chain of command, whereas the Obamas had grown up without staff.
To
say the least. And so although they did go through that sort of chain of command, they were perfectly willing to say, hey, Bill, how about this
right.
or something? Yeah. And the first thing that President Obama ever said to me, and it was in, let me set the stage a little bit. We had all gone to meet him in the East Room, the largest room. And so we were all circled around the outside of the room. He's going around shaking hands with everybody. And we had already served some desserts. So I was sort of like standing there, like ready for his accolades.
Right.
So, yes, I know you've had some of these. And so he comes around and it's, oh, the pastry chef, you make the pies. Yes, sir. stop making so damn many pies.
Because I'm sure you'd heard he was a pie freak, right?
Yeah. There was, you know, that came through. And, I realize it's an occupational hazard. Like, people are always shoving food at you. And, I mean, you don't have to be the president. You can be a senator. You can be a congressman. People are always like, oh, try. This is our most famous, you know, maple fudge.
Right. And he was known to be a pie freak.
Yeah.
And my friend Tom Douglas from Seattle, the chef in Seattle, cooked at a fundraiser.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he made his coconut cream pie, which is famous.
Yes.
And he said to me that President Obama came backstage and said, that was an awesome pie, dude. And, you know, like for Tom, it was like, didn't get any better than
that.
No.
And he doesn't give compliments lightly. And he really, the president, President Obama, really hates like sycophants, flattery, you know. He's very just dead on.
Direct.
Straight on. Very direct. Yeah. So that was his first word, stop making so many pies.
And you thought...
they're so good, blah, blah, blah.
That's really funny. Yeah. So look, man, you have to go, I know. We haven't even gotten to the pie. We haven't even gotten to Michelle's initiative.
Yeah, we have to.
So, you know, and we haven't talked about your book. So will you come back and tell us about life with Michelle Obama and the new book?
Love talking about it. Thank you.
Thanks so much for enlightening us about life in the Obama White House and the Bush White House as well, Bill. And though you are not a leaker, I can tell right now that you are not a leaker.
No.
So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.